The opinions and statements expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WWDB, its staff, or management.
Good day, everyone, and welcome again to another edition of Boomer Generation Radio. This is your host, Richard Address, coming to you from the studios of WWDB AM 860 here in Greater Philadelphia. And we are streaming live on WWDBAM.com. And you can reach the show, as usual, as we've been telling you, on BoomerGenerationRadio@gmail.com or like us on the Boomer Generation Radio Facebook page. And right after this message from our friends at Kendall Corporation, we're going to be back with our guest, Dr. Teresa Cooney, who is going to be our first guest. And on our second segment, our quarterly return visit from Peter Hecht. So, without further ado, in this beautiful day, the city of Philadelphia is still basking in its post-papal visit glow. A word from our friends at Kendall.
Hi, this is Kendall staff member Sheila Sylvester. This portion of Boomer Generation Radio was brought to you by Kendall, a system of not-for-profit communities and services in 8 states that advocates for and empowers older adults to reach their full potential. Please join us in Together Transforming the Experience of Aging. To learn more about Kendall, that's K-E-N-D-A-L, visit discoverkendall.org or call toll-free 888-759-0128.
Welcome back. And through the magic of electronics and the expertise of our producer, Tony, I think we'll have hope. Dr. Cooney, are you there with us?
I am.
Hi. Hi. How are
Hello.
You?
Good morning. I'm good. Thank you.
How are things in Colorado today?
A little cloudy. We might actually get some rain, which is a rare occurrence in Denver in the summer.
Oh, wow. Yes. Well, we've been told that to expect to build an ark for the next week here in Philly. So what can you do? Anyway, thank you very much. We're speaking with Dr. Teresa Cooney, a professor and chair of the Department of Sociology at the University of Colorado in Denver. And we want to talk a little bit. Well, actually, we want to talk a lot about one of your areas of expertise and research, dealing with an aspect of caregiving that, frankly, is rarely in my work around the country and in my work with Jewish Sacred Aging, rarely discussed. But as a clergy person, many of my colleagues, if not all, have run across this in a variety of different ways. Mm-hmm. You have done some research you've done a study on ex-wife caregivers. Could you explain that?
Well, my areas of expertise are families and aging, and I spent a good deal of my career looking at how demographic changes in the U.S. might impact the aging experience as we move into this century. And we know that the baby boom generation was one that experienced very high rates of marital disruption. They were, you know, in the prime ages for divorce during the divorce revolution of the 1970s into the 1980s. And now, as you talk about every week, they're now moving into their later years. And so, given my interests, I was speaking probably about 6-7 years ago now with someone at a VA hospital, and I told her what I was interested in, and she said, well, that's interesting because we see many vets coming into the VA with their ex-wives who are their caregivers. And just as you mentioned, I was kind of shocked by that. I had never thought of ex-wives being an option for caregiving. In all the years I'd been studying these issues about divorce and aging, I had raised the question, who might there be to care for these men as they age? And we can talk about why I was concerned mostly about men. But, you know, the idea of a woman, an ex-wife being the caregiver hadn't really come up for me. So after that discussion with this VA professional, I started to look in the research literature. Of course, there was nothing about this topic. I did find a few articles in popular press, the New York Times, for example, where health professionals said they were seeing this occasionally, and it was a curious situation. And so a colleague of mine at the University of Missouri at the time, Chris Prue, the two of us decided we've got to explore this topic more and figure out what's going on here. what is this experience like for women, and then to consider whether there's kind of opportunity here to do larger studies of the topic.
So you conducted this study. First of all, the phrase "divorce revolution" is a new one. They've actually studied a glitch, an uptick in the numbers of divorces and boomers in the 70s and 80s. Is that true?
Well, demographers showed in the 70s the divorce rate in the U.S. spiked and took off tremendously. And it wasn't just among boomers. It was across a variety of age cohorts. We were seeing more divorces. Part of that was perhaps spurred by the no-fault divorce laws that many states were putting into effect. But we saw that the divorce rates took off, and they continued to climb across a variety of age groups until about 1989, when they peaked. And now they've actually been coming down some and stabilized. However, for people 50 and over today, the divorce rate is still going up. Yeah, and so if you look at that group, that's the baby boomers today.
Yeah, that's we've done a couple of shows with therapists and an elder attorney, too, who does some specialty work. And in fact, she's scheduled to come back for a return sometime in December. But this phenomenon of gray, of they called it, at least the New York Times about 2 years ago in a major article, called it gray divorce, which was really, you know, the empty nest issue. And they turn around and say, you know, I have all these years left, and, you know, it's time for me to move on, or whatever. So
perhaps. I mean, we didn't see it with earlier cohorts of people 50 plus so much.
Right.
So I think it's probably a combination of kind of something about this cohort. They divorced in very high numbers as younger adults, and now they're kind of carrying that relationship pattern into their later years. There's a sociologist at the University of Washington, Pepper Schwartz, and I love this phrase. She says the boomers are relationship innovators. You know, they were some of the first to cohabit outside of marriage. Then they divorced in very high numbers, more remarriage. And now I'm wondering, are they going to be caregiving innovators too?
Well, I think we're starting to see that. I mean, we've done a couple of shows where people are talking about, in fact, I just had this conversation literally with some friends of mine, to be brutally honest, at halftime of the Eagles game on Sunday, where the subject of caregiving and the subject of, you know, looking down the road came up, and we were talking about, you know, different forms of caregiving and communal housing and the village movement. So I think that you're, you know, obviously on to something. But let me get back to your study, because it's fascinating. What did you find was the motivation? It's so counterintuitive to most people that my ex, you know, is going to be the one who's really going to take care of me when I have to be rehabbed or go into the last couple of years of my. What did you find? What was the motivation? What was still? It's almost like a movie that, like, there's still this spark of love that remains there. This commitment. What did you find?
Occasionally, well, let me first give you a little context, because I don't want to imply that this is in any way generalizable, you know, to huge numbers of people. We did a small exploratory study, which is typically what you do when there's been no research in an area.
Right.
You've got to do a small in-depth study so you can identify, you know, what's important to later go out and ask about to larger numbers. So we talked to 21 ex-wife caregivers from about 10 states in the U.S., and we located these women through hospice agencies. So right there, we've got a unique context. Most of these men were on hospice, which is usually for people who are terminal and only have about 6 months left to live. And so we asked these women a lot about, you know, how did this come to be that you took on this role? Why are you doing it? And when we went through these very lengthy interviews, what seemed to come up most often was the women said they were doing it for someone else, not necessarily for themselves or anything they would get out of it, but for someone else. And generally that someone else was their children.
Wow.
All of these women except for two had had children with these men, and some of them said, you know, I don't want my children to have to do this. That might have been because they saw their children as being too busy and involved with, you know, their own lives and having things they had to do in their own lives. Some of them, though, had children who weren't particularly fond of their fathers after kind of chaotic divorces, maybe lapsed periods of seeing him or getting support from him. And so these women oftentimes felt like they could be the ones to come in and take on that role and spare their children this responsibility. And in fact, a few of them, it was their children who suggested or asked them to do it.
Were any of these?
So that was the number one reason.
Were any of these former wives then remarried and then took on this role?
Yes.
Wow.
I would say about, maybe a third of them were remarried. And for the most part, they said their current husbands were supportive of them doing it. Some said, you know, we had to sit down and I had to explain to him, you know, why I was doing this. And for many of them then, it became a situation where the new husband would say, yes, I understand that. If my kids asked me to do that or if I felt like it was going to be a difficult thing for my children, I would probably do that. So they understood. And there were even a couple men who supported their current wives in this task, so would help out as much as they could. So it was an interesting phenomenon. But one thing we know is women don't remarry as often as men after divorce. And so, you know, most of them were not remarried. But for the group that was, they had their husbands behind them on this.
Well, I have to tell you, it's like, this is great. It's like I can just see the Hallmark TV movie on this somewhere. I'm surprised.
Yeah. Well, some of the interviews we said were like novellas. They
have
some
to
very
be.
Dramatic stories.
And
yeah, so that was the number one reason, though. There were a couple other reasons. Some of them said, you know, I felt so much guilt over the years of kind of how this all transpired, or now seeing him so sick, I feel like if I help him, I might feel less guilty about leaving him. That was less common. A few of them talked about kind of feelings of love for the man that had never really gone away. But that, again, wasn't that common. For some of these women, they hadn't seen these men in years, and so it wasn't as if they had an ongoing relationship of any type. And then a few just said, you know, you don't leave people to die alone. They felt,
right.
We call that kind of this generic compassion, that they said, if I didn't do it, I don't know that there would be anyone to do it. Some of these men had really burned a lot of bridges after the divorce. And as we know, sometimes it's difficult post-divorce for men to manage relationships because they've so often depended on their wives to be that kinkeeper, that social secretary, you know. And so some of these men had really not only lost contacts and good relationships with their own children, but even with some of their own families of origin.
There's a certain sadness, pathos about
it is.
This. Really, that does come through. You only dealt with women. Did you have any experience or interviews in the study with men who were taking?
We did not.
Okay.
But when I presented these findings at professional meetings, I have had a few people in my audiences stand up and say, what about men? I've had people from Alzheimer's associations, for example, say that they have seen some men caregivers of ex-wives. My hunch, if I had to go out on a limb, I would say we would see this less from men. And in part, it's because when you look at partners, typically, men marry women who are younger, and men don't live as long as women. So it's typically in a couple, the men who need care first.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one reason we oftentimes see women taking on the role. In divorce, women seem to be better able to maintain their relationships with their children and families post-divorce. So I would think women might have more options out there to turn to rather than turning to an ex. So I just think we'll see it less. Although I was talking about this the other day at a research seminar down in Colorado Springs, and someone in the audience said, I wonder now with same-sex marriage, as we move forward, whether we might see this phenomenon in same-sex male couples. And that's an interesting question.
Another study. We're speaking with Dr. Teresa Cooney, a professor and chair of the Department of Sociology at the University of Colorado in Denver. And we're going to be back with Dr. Cooney to explore some of these other issues of aspects of caregiving right after this word from our friends at Kendall.
Hi, this is Kendall resident Harry Hammond. This portion of Boomer Generation Radio is brought to you by Kendall. Founded on Quaker principles, Kendall provides independent living, assisted living, memory support, skilled nursing and rehabilitation care for older adults in 8 states. Whether you're looking for the intellectual and cultural stimulation of a college town or a big city, Kendall has a community for you. We are together transforming the experience of aging. To learn more, visit Kendall.org. or call toll-free 888-759-0128.
Welcome back to this section of Boomer Generation Radio with Dr. Teresa Cooney, professor and chair of the Department of Sociology at the University of Colorado in Denver. And we're talking about Dr. Cooney's very interesting study on ex-wife caregivers and the phenomenon and the changing demographics and concerns about our aging population, the baby boomers aging, and this challenge of caregiving. So, Dr. Cooney, you do a lot of work and speaking and obviously research and demography dealing with aging and the revolution of longevity. What would you say is that one of the greatest, we all understand the demographic changes, the longevity revolution, the numbers which are swelling. Gazing into your research crystal ball and the stuff that you've done, you study demography, what's one of the two or three greatest challenges now facing us as this demography changes?
I think the care issues are a major concern, and that's definitely what we see the most research on in our field, because we know that regardless of how healthy you are, the longer you live, the more likely you are to experience some functional impairments or cognitive impairments that will perhaps require some caregiving. And it might just be short-term care. It could be longer-term care. But there's the issue of who's going to do it and how are we going to be able to support those caregivers, not only financially, but socially, emotionally. Caregiving can be a daunting task, even for someone who's wanting to do it and has strong feelings for the care recipient. It's a tough task to take on with other roles people have at work, in their own families. And so I do think that'll be a major issue. And, there's been a lot of discussion about how to support that. And especially with people living longer and projections about Alzheimer's disease, for example, that raises concern because we know that cognitive care for people who are cognitively impaired, that's some of the toughest caregiving. And with Alzheimer's, you don't really have a good sense of how long that situation may go on. Some people live decades with Alzheimer's and need extensive care. So I think that's probably one of the issues that we worry about the most.
We're finding in some of the research that I've done and some of the guests that we've had on the show who speak about this, that projecting out and referring in many ways to the expected growth in dementia and Alzheimer's, that over the next 20, 30 years, as boomers age out, that there literally will not be enough qualified caregivers to take care of our generation. Is your research finding that?
Well, I haven't done any systematic research on that, but I know in the field of aging, we talk quite a bit about whether we'll have an adequate workforce to deal with that huge swell of older adults as the boomers move into late life. And it's a tough sell. As a college professor, I'll tell you, it's a tough sell to make to young people, to convince them to go into the field of gerontology or some aspect of healthcare involving older populations. A lot of young people don't have a great deal of experience with older adults, so they seem strange and, they're not totally comfortable around them. They see the issue issue of caring for people who are near death, something that is not appealing to think about doing day in and day out. And so I know in my own teaching and trying to convince students of where to emphasize their studies and think about careers, I don't get a lot of takers when I talk about gerontology. And I think that shows kind of what our job or, you know, our market is in terms of people who will be available to work in that field.
I mean, you teach,
and I think you see the same thing in medicine.
Right. Actually, we found that to be true in some of the people mm-hmm. who, some of the geriatricians and docs who deal with this who come on. In mm-hmm. in you're a sociologist. Do you find that part of this reluctance, when you strip away some of the, you know, the facadal issues, really has to do with a fear of younger people dealing with older people, buying into some sort of ageism?
I think I would say there probably is some fear. And like I just mentioned, a lack of familiarity with older adults. You know, some sociologists have written about what an age-segregated society we are compared to many other developed nations. Mm-hmm. And it's true that we don't have a lot of opportunities in our society, in many of our institutions, for example, where young and old can come together and become more familiar with one another. The family is probably one of the few places to do that. And yet, when I talk to young people about older adults, they always see their own family members as exceptional. So I'll say, well, you know, you have fun and good times with them, and they'll be like, yeah, but that's my grandma. You know,
right.
That's not someone else's 80-year-old grandma.
Right. She's really not 80. So, she's really 20. Yeah.
Right. So I used to teach classes where I would bring older adults from the community into the classroom, and we called them our aging informants. They would the students would ask questions of them, and they always loved that part of the class. They would talk afterwards about, that was my favorite thing we did in class. I really enjoyed that. I was so surprised at their humor and their life experience. And I said, but this isn't exceptional. This is the older adult population, but they really have so little interaction, I think, that they don't understand that. And so I think if we could create more interaction, there would be more people perhaps interested and comfortable pursuing careers in that area.
Do you see that happening, or do you in slowly but surely in the society, or do you still see things?
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm not too hopeful, you know.
Really?
We read more and more today about, you know, you read so much, for example, about workplaces where there's conflict with millennials and boomers, you know, in the workplace because they have such different approaches to things and values. And so I don't know. I don't feel like it's changing very quickly, and I'm not so sure I'm hopeful about that. It's hard to change social patterns and institutions quickly.
Yeah, just ask Congress. Before we start running out of time, there was a rather interesting article about 3 months ago in July, which I think is about 3 months now, in the New York Times about the nature of the article was the caregivers who are themselves older adults caring for other older adults.
Right.
That present all kinds of additional challenges because that 75-year-old or 80-year-old person who's caring for their 85-year-old spouse.
Mm-hmm. Or their 100-year-old mother.
Or their 100-year-old mother, yeah. They themselves mm-hmm. are in need of care. And the when you factor in, you know, adult children who may be living out of town, you know, the long distance phenomenon, mm-hmm. have you run across a lot of this? I think the article used the concept of caregiver burden, where mm-hmm. it's just so overwhelming that just people's physical ability to take care of people, and yet they fight like heck not to place someone in a facility.
Right. Yeah, I think, well, the last comment you made is so true, and it's one I always have to correct people on. I think people have this image that here in the United States, we put people in nursing homes that they're a dumping ground for our older adults, and they're really not. They're the situation of last resort when people just don't have the capacity or the skills needed to care any longer in the home. And yeah, there is this likelihood that we will see, you know, multiple older generations needing care. because people are living longer. One of the things we see today, we hear a lot about, you know, that sandwich generation. Mm-hmm. And I always have to, again, correct people. It's not that most caregivers are caring for an elderly parent and then caring for a young child. Most caregivers are around 60. They're not going to have a preschooler or a school-age child, but they might have a grandchild that's needing regular child care or might even be living in the home. And so, yeah, there's a lot of this kind of mixed demand. They may not go on for long term. They might be short term situations, but they still can be very challenging. And people do want to do what they can. I mean, the women in our study, you know, they didn't have access to things like family medical leave because they weren't legally related to these men. So some of them were trying to juggle work, which was not very understanding of their situation, and doing the care for these men. So I think oftentimes caregivers are trying to kind of do everything, keep themselves going, do their jobs, meet other family roles. And, you know, because we see giving care as a really important role in our lives. Women are oftentimes very committed to that role, and it's socialized into us, and we take it on with, you know, as much energy as we can. And so I think, yes, we're going to see that. And oftentimes, as for these ex-wife caregivers, they really saw a lack of supports, right? They'd say to us, there were no support groups out there for ex-wives.
Wow.
Or they felt like they couldn't talk about this very much, even with friends, because many friends were judgmental of them taking on that role. Many people just didn't understand why they were doing it. So rather than when they had a hard day calling up a friend, they wouldn't talk to others because they didn't want others judging them in their choice. So this whole idea of caregiver support, it's really important.
In your research, are you seeing any type of groundswell, maybe the wrong word, but a little glimmer of hope on the part of state legislators passing laws that really will support family caregiving and for tax breaks, family leave? I know there's a bill, I think, in New Jersey that's modeled after some others that really will affirm this and with credits. And are you seeing any of this?
Yeah. Well, if it's out there, I think it's very scattered. And, you know, I would love to see national policy in place. You know, it was a good step with the Family Medical Leave Act, but the Family Medical Leave Act is really just a Band-Aid. If you compare that legislation with what other developed nations have, where you can get paid leave, you know, sometimes up to a year for child care or other sorts of care needs in your families, then giving someone up to 12 weeks of unpaid leave really sounds minimal, and it is minimal. Many people can't take it because they can't afford to be without a paycheck. So, you know, there are, I think, some attempts throughout the country, and I don't know the details of all of them, but it's very scattered, and we really haven't taken on this issue, I think, at the national level to say, what can we do to support families as our demographic is changing and there's this huge demand for care.
Dr. Teresa Cooney, the professor of sociology and chair of the Department of Sociology at the University of Colorado at Denver, and I want to thank you very much for joining us here on Boomer Generation Radio. Fascinating study, fascinating insights, and I really thank you for giving us your time and continued good luck in your teaching and research. And again, thank you very much for being a guest here on Boomer Generation
Radio.
You're
very welcome.
Take care.
Thank you. Bye.
We'll be back with our second segment featuring the return of the famous Peter Hecht. Of Hecht Investment Group, one of our good friends, Johnny Montgomery Scott. You can reach them, by the way, at 855-289-2168. That's the Hecht Investment Group's toll-free number, and they're at hechtinvestmentgroup.com. We'll be back with Peter for the second segment of Boomer Generation Radio. And to take us into that second segment, it's a good day for a little Beatles.
With you, would you promise to be true and help me
understand, 'cause I've been in love before, and I found that love was more than just holding hands.
Hi, this is Kendall's staff member, Sheila Sylvester. This portion of Boomer Generation Radio is brought to you by Kendall. Founded on Quaker principles, Kendall provides independent living, assisted living, memory support, skilled nursing, and rehabilitation care for older adults in 8 states. Whether you're looking for the intellectual and cultural stimulation of a college town or a big city, Kendall has a community for you. We are together transforming the experience of aging. To learn more, visit Kendall.org or call toll-free 888-759-0128.
And welcome back to the second segment of Boomer Generation Radio here on WWDB AM 860 in Philadelphia and streaming live on WWDBAM.com. And again, you can reach us at Boomer Generation Radio at gmail.com and on Facebook, like us at the Boomer Generation Radio Facebook page. And we are delighted to welcome back for one of his regular visits here to Boomer Generation Radio, Mr. Peter Hecht of the Hecht Investment Group of Janney Montgomery Scott, located in beautiful southern New Jersey. Peter, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good morning.
Good morning, sir. How are you today?
Great, great. How are you?
I'm hanging in, you know. It's not too bad. It's like, the traffic was crazy this morning here, so you're lucky you're in Jersey. So there's so much to talk about. Thrust of one of the beginning of this conversation is really for our generation, baby boom generation, taking a look every morning at this volatility of the stock market. Perhaps wondering what in the world's going on, what to do. I just saw a posting on from a colleague of mine on another internal website this morning before the show, literally posting what should I do about my pension? I don't know what to do, et cetera, given the stock market. I'm sure you get calls like this on a regular basis. And I know Hecht Investment Group, as we mentioned here on the show, sends out regular updates to clients about managing the volatility. But what do you make of this up and down, up and down? Yesterday, 300 points down, today up, tomorrow down. How do you caution people to just stay cool?
Well, historically, we have short memories, but this has gone on in the market for 4 decades, and right now it's China, and it's interest rates, and it's, you know, it's always some type of issue. It's Russia, and you know, whatever it may be. But when you look at, and we're going to put a piece out today. When you look at the fundamentals of the markets, earnings are still strong. Interest rates obviously are low. Even if they raise rates, they're not going to raise them dramatically, and markets historically have done fine in a rising interest rate environment. That a lot of the fundamentals of the market are still there, and there's not a lot of places that people can go to get a decent return on their monies. So right now we're advising people that unless things have changed in your life, illnesses, deaths, job losses, career changes, new homes bought or sold, things of that nature, there's really no sense in changing right now, and we just have to live through these volatile times.
So in other words, just stay the course.
Correct. Stay the course. We try and stay in touch with our clients on a regular basis, so they're expecting or know our position when these times arrive. And it seems like staying the course is the best way to go at this point. You know, whenever we're in the middle of whatever it is, whether it's an up market or a down market or a volatile market, we feel like it's never going to end. But right. At some point, it will end.
So to our generation, the baby boom generation, who are, and many of whom are now retired or semi-retired, or many of whom on the back end of the boomers contemplating retirement or looking at some major transition in their life, what advice can we give? Well, let's take that second group. What advice can you really give to this group, let's say in their late 50s, early 60s, who are saying, gee, you know, in the next couple of years, I really do want to transition out of full-time work and either open my bakery or go hiking, or like this guy we had on last week, go say, you know, the heck with it and go travel the world, but I have to make sure I have enough money to do that. What advice do you give them? Just stay the course or begin to make a plan and really sit down and seriously evaluate where you are?
Oh, you have to make a plan. You have to have a plan. We've discussed this before,
right,
with you on the show, and we say in the business, rather tongue-in-cheek, that people spend more time planning a vacation than they do their retirement. So it's important that they meet with their advisors, their financial advisor, their accountant, if they have an estate planning attorney, because it's a team. And you need to meet with those people, develop a plan that you feel comfortable with in regards to your age, your risk level, you know, what you're looking for in terms of retirement, and, you know, pretty much stick with that plan. You may want to fine-tune it as we go along. And reduce exposure to the equity market, the stock market. But you have to plan. You have to plan, and you have to have a process of how you're going to go about this. Nobody's just going to retire and start playing golf the next day. If they do, they're in trouble.
So you alluded to something, Peter, that, you know, again, giving the what you do as a financial advisor, how often should someone sit down with their financial advisor? Is this like a 6 month checkup? Every 6 months you come in, because you alluded to before, just life changes things. You know, people move, or they have grandchildren, or whatever. Do you suggest a regular time period?
Good question. I can only tell you what we do. We have a process that we call 12, 4, and 2. We're in touch with our clients every month. Four of those are a quarterly review, and two of those are in person. Now, that's at a minimum. If someone needs to see us more often or needs to hear from us more often, we'll arrange to do that. But we're in touch with our clients just about every month.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's a short conversation. You know, you had this surgery. How you doing? Everything okay? Things are okay on this end. Do you have any questions for us? No, we don't. Okay, great. We'll talk to you next month.
Okay.
And between that and what we send out to our clients, we like to keep them well informed. And of course, we do, as you know, dinners and seminars and workshops.
Yeah, you have one coming up, if I'm not mistaken, in the middle of October on nutrition.
Yes, we're having it on, we like to educate, our clients and their friends and associates. We have, on October 15th, Thursday, between 6 and 8, we are having at the Moorestown Mall at the Harvest, Seasonal Grill and Wine Bar. We're having a workshop, entitled Healthy Eating Habits, and we have brought in a nutritionist, Bonnie Duboff, who is from the Atlantic City area, but I met her through Virtua in Moorestown, and she is going to do the presentation and talk to people about learning how to optimize their diet through healthy habits. So that's what she helped me with, was changing my eating habits, not just going on a diet. So we have that coming up, and then we're looking at covering issues, and you and I talked about it this weekend. We're going to set something up for the reality of the end of life issues.
Mm-hmm.
That is very important, and something that you talk about a great deal with, particularly with children and their parents. We're going to set something up on navigating the healthcare maze, you know, with the changes in healthcare, and then we're going to also have one on cybersecurity. So. Those are the kinds of things that we like to do with our clients to keep them informed.
So I got to ask you this question, because somebody's sitting there and saying, well, wait a minute, I understand that HEC does financial planning and advice, et cetera, but what does nutrition have to do with financial planning?
One of the first things that we ask people when we sit down with them, we're not lawyers. We ask them, have they done any estate planning? Do they have a simple will? Do they have any trusts set up? And we also ask them about their health.
Mm-hmm.
How is their health? How is the health of other members of their family? Are there parents that are ill? Is there a child that has special needs? Health is very important, because when you're retiring, are a lot of your assets, if you're not in good health, are a lot of your assets going to need to be spent on your health care? So we do this because we like healthy clients, and we want people to, right, as you well know. And we think it's important for people to take care of their health so they can plan their future.
So that raises a really serious question, because it does follow up on the conversation that we alluded to in many ways in the first segment. What I call the economics of aging. How do you sit down with a family? Let's say they come to see you. They're 62 years old. They're in transition, in their early 60s. Their parents, one or both sets of parents, are still maybe alive, and introduce this subject of, you need to start putting some money away, because God forbid your own health care needs. It may be a home health worker, it may be a surgery, it may be whatever, a COTA or health insurance. Do people understand that concept looking in the future, or do this too many people wait until the last minute and say, oh my God, I have to write a check for $3,000 a month for my mom's assisted living or for my husband's assisted living?
It's difficult to say what the numbers are, but we try and get to people as early as possible. So when we first meet with a client or a prospective client, this is one of the issues that we talk about. So if they haven't done any planning, they can start looking at that. We have certain resources that we can utilize and refer them to assist them. But it's certainly, you know, a significant part of the plan. And so when people haven't prepared for something like this, we get them to start thinking about it, talking about it, looking at their assets. How are we going to put that money aside? What are we going to do? What kind of assisted care is there for them in the community, or for their parents in the community? So it's a whole range of services and it's a matter of tapping those services so they can help our clients.
Yeah, I would imagine it, that first conversation when somebody sits down with you to look at the future and they have these plans of, you know, three cruises to the Bahamas or to Venice, and then you introduce, you know, it's wonderful, but what happens if, you know, you have to take care of mom or dad or you have to take care of yourself? That can be a very sobering conversation.
Correct. It certainly can. I would say, though, Rich, that many of the people that we work with, all of the people that we work with, and many of the people that are referred to us are already thinking of those things. It's so out there. It's so,
right.
You know, programs like your own, TV, the news, you know, the media, social media. It's really out there for, I think almost someone would have to have their head stuck in the sand if they weren't aware of these types of issues that they need to talk to somebody.
Well, it's very. I know. We've talked about this. That people probably don't realize this, but you do because I've seen you do it. A significant amount of what in our ballpark we would call pastoral counseling, because people come with very serious. It's a person, and money is perhaps one of the most personal things a family or an individual can talk about, and it usually, as you see in your office every day, opens the doors to all kinds of other personal and sometimes psychological and family dynamic issues that you have to deal with. And I think people don't realize that a good financial planner like you guys are really do deal with a lot of these issues sometimes in a very direct and sometimes in a wonderfully sort of like supportive fashion. So that's important to understand. We're speaking with Peter Hecht of the Hecht Investment Group of Janney Montgomery Scott, located in southern New Jersey. And again, you can reach the Hecht Investment Group at 855-289-2168. That's 855-289-2168. And you can visit them at thehechtinvestmentgroup.com. We'll be back with Peter to explore some of the other issues that are percolating around the current financial markets and its impact upon our generation and our children's generation right after this word from our friend at Kendall.
Hi, this is Kendall resident Harry Hammond. This portion of Boomer Generation Radio is brought to you by Kendall Outreach. Kendall Outreach serves the field of aging by raising public awareness of important health care issues of older adults, and it provides education and training in the development and implementation of comprehensive approaches to safe, individualized, long-term care practices. Kendall Outreach has been sharing Kendall's approaches to quality care with consumers, advocates, providers, government agencies, and related organizations since 1989. To learn more, visit KendallOutreach.org.
And welcome back to Boomer Generation Radio, coming to you as we do every week on WWDB AM 860 here in Greater Philadelphia, streaming live on WWDBAM.com. And we're back with Peter Hecht of the Hecht Investment Group of Janney Montgomery Scott. Peter, I have to ask you this question because it occurred to me yesterday while I was channel surfing. Looking for sports talk and on TV. And lo and behold, I bump into all these pundits. I guess that's the right word. Financial pundits, CNBC, what all these other channels. They're dispensing advice with machine gun rapidity. Bang, bang, bang. Buy, sell, hold. Don't do this. They're horrible. This is good. How effective are these people? Do people come into your office and say, holding the sheet of papers of saying, look, I heard on CNBC or Fox Business or whatever, I have to buy this. This is going to go up. Does this happen a lot?
It happens a good bit. I think you know we don't do a lot in the way of individual stocks.
I know. Yeah.
However, I'll answer you this way. I have a little TV in my office, and it's on CNBC, and it's on mute. The reason I have it set up that way is because obviously, if something happens, it's on the screen, and I can see the breaking news. The reason it's on mute is because most of what I listen or what you hear on these stations, and with due respect to all of those brilliant minds, is noise. And there'll be someone on in the morning that'll tell you this is the worst time to own stocks, bonds, whatever, put everything in cash and stuff it in a mattress. And then that afternoon, there'll be someone on who will say, this is the best buying opportunity in the stock market, in the bond market, in the commodities market, you know, whatever it is.
Right.
And that you should be putting, you know, remortgage your house and put your money in, into the markets. So, and everything in between. So, I tell people that's great, and oftentimes, as I'm sure you hear in your profession, someone said, or they say,
the mythical they.
Ask,
the
who's
mythical.
The someone, and who is the they, okay? Because you can hear anything you want.
All right.
Without being too political, if you want to be, if you want to hear the conservative slant in the news, listen to Fox. If you want to listen to the liberal slant in the news, listen to MSNBC, and they'll confirm what you already believe.
Right. That's true. That's true. And I'm just fascinated because there's so much noise on the air. That's why I think, as we talk about this, the slow and steady, in essence, just sit down and talk to somebody over the long haul approach, as you do, winds up being the best for everybody. Let me ask you another couple of questions before we start.
Let me interrupt 1 second. That's why we do a financial plan, or what we call a retirement income analysis,
right,
when we first meet with someone.
Well, you do.
So we all have everything in writing in front of us.
We've talked about this before. I mean, the idea of, I think you call it a concierge service.
Yes.
That really personalizes, and I think that's something that people should look for, as opposed to sort of like the off-the-rack supermarket thing where, you know, I saw it in the Wall Street Journal or I saw it on TV at 10 o'clock at night. Because somebody said something, and I think that. But that the challenge of that, I think, for a lot of people, is that it takes time. It really does take time. You have to make an appointment. You have to go in and see somebody. You have to be able to deal with what the person tells you, which may not be what you want to hear. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a lot of people. I think, you know, it goes back to the investment of time. But as you've said, and as other people on the show have said, this is your life. If you can't take the time to organize it and make a plan, then you have to ask yourself some serious questions about really what is going on, because this is your life.
Yes.
How important is the impact? We hear this all the time. I heard it again this morning on the news coming over to the station. How important are international events? Economically and politically, how much of an impact do they really have on markets? And how much should we pay attention to it?
It's kind of a double-edged sword. I mean, the world has gotten smaller. So what happens in China or Russia or Europe, you know, can have an impact on us and vice versa. However, a lot of these are events. And so what I think people need to avoid is having knee-jerk reactions to certain events. Remember not long ago, Greece was going to go off the face of the earth.
Right.
We don't hear anything about Greece anymore, okay? Now it's the Ukraine and Syria and, you know, whatever it may be. So political events are just that. They're events, and they eventually pass. Now, the flip side of that is certainly from an economic standpoint, from a fundamental standpoint, what goes on in other countries can have an effect on us. I mean, you know, we have trade agreements. We share information. We share products, you know, throughout the world. I mean, Apple is not it's based in the U.S., but it certainly is a worldwide product. So, you know, Coca-Cola has more foreign investments and placements than they do here in the United States. So it's double-edged in the sense that you don't want to overreact to things, but certainly we're connected. We're all connected. You know what happens in the economies. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, I mean, the reason why I raise it is because of so many people, I see, you know, sort of like an amateur in very much with a capital A in this, but you see this, you know, the oil prices are down per barrel. So, wow, you know, you drive by the local gas station and the prices are down, and that, you know, Shell goes off the north in the Arctic and stops drilling because it's just not worth their money to drill anymore because of the oil prices. There's this, like you said, this interconnectedness, and I guess that puts a little bit more pressure if you take this seriously, as many families do, of not jumping to every event, as you call it, on the news, because if you probably did that every day, you would be on the phone with your person or stuff like that and saying, well, do this, do that, or do this, do that. I guess the conservative sort of like just wait and see what happens and just hold on to things is probably, from what I'm hearing you say, is still the best approach.
Yeah, it sounds like an old phrase and a broken phrase, but it's really true. Diversification, balance. You know, if you're younger and in your 30s and 40s, you're probably going to be a little bit more aggressive than if you're in your 60s, 70s, or 80s. But the point is that you have to have some balance in your portfolio so that you can guard against some of these, not all, of these the volatility and the changes in the world.
Let me
our portfolios have some international exposure.
Right.
You know, but we certainly don't want to overweight it.
Let me shift gears here before we start running out of time here, because you alluded to, you know, when you're younger and a more aggressive. We keep reading in the popular press that there's a real generational divide perhaps coming up. There was an article in one of the websites that I cruise for my aging stuff that mentioned that the Gen X are my children's generation really have no set financial plan. The majority of that generation really hasn't even begun. These are people in their late 30s, 40s. Who have not really begun to plan for the future because they just haven't done it, or because their economic situation doesn't give them the opportunity to do that. How do you begin to tell or educate that Gen X group that this is really important, as you're, even though you have young children and you may be in the process, that this is something that's going to be important to you to start planning?
Well, fortunately for us and for the families that we work with a lot of the children of the parents that we initially started working with. And it's very important. It's very important that they start initially. Research a little bit yourself. If it doesn't interest you, you know, find someone that you can talk to about it, or try and meet with someone. If your family is working with someone, certainly that might be a good place to start, to meet and talk to that individual. The Fidelities and the Vanguards of the world are loaded with information, and anybody in the investment community, whether they're with an investment firm or they're with like a Fidelity or a Vanguard, they're more than happy to talk to you. But yeah, you need to start. You got to do your homework. You know, you don't want to wake up and all of a sudden you're 50, 55 years old and you haven't done any planning.
Would you say that even the millennials, the kids in their 20s who are literally just starting out and really feeling the impact of a lot of economic downturn, even that generation, it would be worthwhile to begin to think about this?
Absolutely.
Wow.
Absolutely. We look at it as like going to the doctor. Mm-hmm. You know, when are you going to start seeing a doctor? You know, do you wait till you have something seriously wrong with you?
So this is really...
You go ahead. You know, you go beforehand and say, and the doctor could turn to you and say, you know what, you're in great shape. Let's do this. Let's try that. And then you're on your way.
Wow. So this is really, it's a good way to end this idea preventive financial planning for the next several generations. It's a great idea. Maybe a good seminar coming up. That would be very, very worthwhile. We've been speaking with Peter Hecht of the Hecht Investment Group of John A. Montgomery Scott on one of his regular visits here to Boomer Generation Radio. Lots of good stuff today. Again, Peter, thank you. Again, you can reach the Hecht Investment Group at 855-289-2168. That's toll-free and HechtInvestmentGroup.com. Peter, thank you to all of you. Thank you again for joining us on Boomer Generation Radio. Have a safe week. Stay healthy. And we'll see you next Tuesday, 10 a.m. Eastern, Boomer Generation Radio here on WWDB. Take care. Thanks again, Peter.